Okay. So today, this morning, Friday morning, somebody asked in one of the question periods to give a talk on the seven factors of enlightenment. And so that's the talk this evening on the seven factors of enlightenment. In brief, the seven factors of enlightenment are mindfulness, which is sati, the investigation of dhammas or states called dhammavicaya. There's wirya called energy. There is piti, this joy which comes up in the mind. There's the tranquility, prasadi. There is meditation, samadhi, and also upeka, equanimity. Those are the seven enlightenment factors. And they're called enlightenment factors because not only when they are cultivated and fulfilled do they lead to enlightenment, but also that when they're present in you in their fullness. And that's one of the descriptions of an enlightened person. And so when people hear this, they hear the seven facts of enlightenment, they start looking inside themselves and see if they're enlightened yet. And sometimes they think, you know, have I got mindfulness? Have I got investigation of states? Have I got energy? Have I got tranquility? Have I got joy? Have I got tranquility? Have I got some samadhi? Have I got equanimity? And just too easy people, because they really want to become enlightened, think, oh yeah, I've got those things, maybe I am enlightened after all. However, that these enlightenment factors are far deeper than that. Because sometimes people want to practice out in the world and live out in the world, and many people are going around these days saying they're enlightened, or they say that other people are enlightened. And they say that even like when they're listening to music, they say, oh, I'm perfectly mindful. And they say, I'm investigating, you know, what the music is that's going on, and especially if it's like fine music, they say that, you know, I've got energy, I'm not falling asleep when I'm listening to Bach, and I've got sort of some joy coming up, it's beautiful music, and I'm just so tranquil. If you're listening to Jimi Hendrix, the tranquility factor of enlightenment would not be there. And I've got some samadhi, I'm one-pointed on what I'm doing, and equanimity, I must be enlightened. But of course, that's not what those enlightenment factors truly mean. And to say what they really mean, what the enlightenment factors really mean, I'm going to just read out what the Buddha said these enlightenment factors truly are. And this is again from the Majjhima Nikaya. This is on one of the most beautiful suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, all about meditation, the Anapana Sati Sutta, the Buddha's teaching on the cultivation of the mindfulness of breath. So these are the enlightenment factors. And how monks do the four foundations of mindfulness develop and cultivated, fulfill the seven enlightenment factors? First of all, mindfulness. On whatever occasion a monk abides contemplating either body or in their feelings, contemplating mind or mind objects, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away this covetousness and grief for the world, in other words, having abandoned the five hindrances, on that occasion, unremitting mindfulness is established in him. On whatever occasion unremitting mindfulness is established in a monk, on that occasion, the mindfulness enlightenment factor is aroused and he develops it, and by developing it, it comes to fulfillment in him. Abiding thus mindful, he investigates and examines that state with wisdom and embarks upon a full inquiry into it. On whatever occasion, abiding thus mindful, a monk investigates and examines that state with wisdom and embarks upon a full inquiry into it. On that occasion, the investigation of state's enlightenment factor is aroused. They develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment. If one who investigates and examines that state with wisdom and embarks upon a full inquiry, tireless energy is aroused. On whatever occasion tireless energy is aroused in a monk who investigates and examines that state with wisdom and embarks upon a full inquiry into it, on that occasion the energy enlightenment factor is aroused. They develop it, and by developing it, it comes to fulfillment. One who has aroused energy, unworldly rapture arises. on whatever occasion unworldly rapture arises, on that occasion a rapture enlightenment factor is aroused. They develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment. In one who is rapturous, the body and the mind become tranquil. On whatever occasion the body and the mind become tranquil, in one who is rapturous, on that occasion the tranquility enlightenment factor is aroused. They develop it, and by developing it, it comes to fulfillment. In one whose body is tranquil and who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. Samadhi. On whatever occasion the mind becomes concentrated, in a bhikkhu whose body is tranquil and who feels pleasure, on that occasion the concentration enlightenment factor is aroused. You develop it, and by developing it, it comes to fulfillment. He closely looks on with equanimity at the mind thus concentrated. On whatever occasion a monk closely looks on with equanimity at the mind thus concentrated, on that occasion the equanimity enlightenment factor is aroused, they develop it, and by developing it, it comes to fulfillment. Now I mention that because that puts all these seven enlightenment factors in a context. It's not just any old mindfulness, it's just not any old energy, it's not just any old equanimity. You know, when you look upon equanimity of meditating or not meditating this morning, when you sort of equanimity, I might as well stay in bed, because just going to the meditation, that's just desire that's created to become enlightened. I might as well just be equanimous. Because that sort of equanimity is not what is meant by the equanimity enlightenment factor. I remember some of the Western monks in the early years in Thailand, when we were going on alms land in the morning, we'd see all these water buffaloes sort of just grazing in the paddy fields. And these water buffaloes would just graze there all day, so just so peaceful, so tranquil. And some of the monks asked Ajahn Chah, is that what equanimity means? Just like being like a water buffalo. And Ajahn Chah said, that's what stupidity means. Because sometimes, for many people, there's not much difference between stupidity and equanimity. So you've got to be very careful there. This is an equanimity which can look on with samadhi. Let's go right back to the very beginning. First of all, mindfulness. Actually, what is mindfulness when it's an enlightenment factor? Because, again, this word mindfulness in Buddhist circles is so abused. And all sorts of people say they're mindful. I've even heard some teachers say in the West that you can be mindful having sex. And so they say that it's okay, as long as you're mindful. What it says over here is you abide contemplating body as body, not somebody else's body, your body, contemplating Vedana, mind. So I've got to say these things because sometimes people are stupid. Mind as mind, and mind objects as mind objects. Now look, ardent, fully aware, mindful, having put away the five hindrances. That's how to be mindful. Because if you've got the five hindrances there, any one of them, you're not mindful. You can't be. The hindrances are that which obscure wisdom. You just cannot see. It's like you're looking at life through tinted glasses, or you're looking at it through sort of dirty glasses. So you can't really pick out all the details. For example, when there's sensory desire, lust, you, at that time, the mindfulness is not for. Very often, it's not mindfulness there at all, when there's lust. You can't really see what's truly there. Why is it that boys and girls go courting each other at night time? They go to restaurants which are candlelit, so they can't see each other's faces. They go to nightclubs, which are again dark, so they don't really know what they're going out with. Because they do this because when there's not mindfulness there, that lust is free to imagine and project and to see something which is not really there, which is never there, which can never be there. However, people do that and they take alcohol because again, that lessens the mindfulness, and it's well known that there's much more romance after a few glasses of wine than after a few glasses of herbal tea. Why is that? It's not because the wine tastes nice. It's because it just takes away your mindfulness enough for perception to come under the control of sensory desire, so that you see what you want to see rather than what's truly there. You see what lust wants you to see, what hope wants you to see. And this is where people get in big trouble. So if you're truly mindful, you have to put away the five hindrances. If you have ill will, can you be truly mindful? And already mentioned during the meditation, which you've been doing, if you're trying to watch the breath and you've got ill will, you just cannot do it. You cannot be mindful of the breath with ill will. You can force yourself for a while, but after a while, just the mind will rebound. And will just go anywhere else, somewhere else, anywhere but here. The only way to be mindful is to have that sense of contentment or kindness. Where there's ill will there, there is no mindfulness. And that's again why, when you get angry at someone, you just completely lose it. You're not really quite sure who you're getting angry at. And sometimes you get angry at your friends, sometimes angry at your parents you love very much, sometimes angry at your husband and wife. You could even get angry at your favourite monk. For ringing the bell too early, or ringing the bell too late, or giving talks and whatever else it is. So it's so easy to get angry at anybody. That ill will, I remember seeing people when you're driving along in a car, and they're in a rush, as many people are when they go to work in the morning or even during the daytime, and they come to the traffic lights and you can see them. So when you come next to them in the monk's car, the monastery car, they're fuming and angry and they're swearing at the traffic lights. And you can really imagine their mind. It's as if the traffic light saw them coming, and the traffic light decided to stay green so the car in front could go through, but they saw this one, and they knew this fellow was in a rush. They knew he was late for work, they knew he had an important, and they went red just for spite, and they did it on purpose. And that traffic light does it on purpose every Monday. You start sort of fantasizing and sort of getting into this anger, this ill will. You completely lose your mindfulness. That traffic lights don't have consciousness. We've been talking about karma. You cannot get reborn as a traffic light. It's just automatic. So it doesn't do it just to spite you. It's got nothing against you. It didn't do it on purpose. Exactly the same way that sometimes your husband or your wife does things. And you think, you did it on purpose, didn't you? You did that to spite me. You knew I was in a rush today. Why did you do that today? I said, what have I done? I didn't mean to do that. It's just like the traffic light. They're just acting in their ordinary, normal function. But you project with ill will a meaning which just isn't there. That's where ill will comes from. You can get angry at anything. You can get angry at a Buddha, you can get angry at a traffic light, you can get angry at your meditation cushion. It's just too hard. I shouldn't have brought you. When there's ill will, it can go anywhere. And this is why the ill will blocks mindfulness. You cannot be mindful when you have ill will at the same time. Again, ill will means you can't see truly as things are. Same with sloth and torpor. Obviously, when you've got sloth and torpor, you're so dull you can't really see anything at all. That's why when people are really dull and dozy, they walk into things. They fall over things because they're half asleep. The same when you're restlessness, when you're restless, or when you've got lots of remorse. Again, that blinds the mind. You can't be mindful if you're restless. You can look at something for only for a few moments. That's not mindfulness at all. Same when there's doubt. This doubt is another form of restlessness. The mind always thinking, wondering about this and that, never really being able to stay with something. So the five hindrances are those which also block mindfulness. Imagine that gatekeeper. If that gatekeeper was really watching the television with sensory desire, and he was so involved in the sensory desire of what he was watching, a really beautiful movie, would he be able to do his job of watching people go in and go out? If we're so angry because the boss didn't pay him that day, he'd say, blow you, I'm not going to watch anything. With ill will, he wouldn't be able to do his job. With sloth and torpor, if he's always just dozing at his post. If he's so restless, he was always going backwards and forwards and never really watching. who was doubting, didn't know really where he was supposed to be watching. Could that be called mindfulness? Would that be a good gatekeeper? Would the gatekeeper be able to perform the job? So for the mindfulness enlightenment factor, it has to be mindfulness which is free of the five hindrances. That's why even here it says, when the ardent, fully aware, mindful, having put away the five hindrances, on that occasion, unremitting mindfulness is established. That's the sort of mindfulness which is needed as the enlightenment factor. The mindfulness which is unremitting, which is not just drip, 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 but which is always there like a constant stream. But it's, again, mindfulness is not just being aware, it's also remembering the instructions, remembering the teachings. And this is in particular where the enlightenment factor of unremitting mindfulness is pointing to the unremitting mindfulness of the basic Buddhist teachings. So if mindfulness enlightenment factor is the true enlightenment factor, it's not just awareness, it's also keeping in mind Four Noble Truths, keeping in mind impermanence, unsatisfactoriness or dukkha, the non-self. Keep it in mind unremittingly. So whatever you see, whatever you feel, whatever you taste, whatever you think, the mind always perceives and thinks about it in terms of insubstantiality. This is going to rise, it's going to fall. I know this, this is how I look at it. So you can never try and attach to it. You never want to attach to it. You never even attempt or lean to attachment because you know it's going to pass away. You look at every moment like that. Everything which comes into your mind, which comes into your field of vision, which comes into your body, is just something which is coming and going. You look at it as the dukkha, the suffering in life. So when there's a pain or disappointment, you don't get upset and angry at it. You say, this is life, this is dukkha. When you get sick, you know you're going to get better or you're going to die. When you get better and you get sort of happy, you know it's not going to last. You keep this all in mind, so you're never shocked. When somebody rings up from home saying that someone has died, you say, I expected that. Because you keep the Dhamma in mind all the time. You didn't know that person was going to die, but you knew that because they were born, that one day they had to die. It doesn't matter what age they're at. So you never get shocked, or disappointed, or surprised by the facts of life. You keep all those dhammas in mind. That way, you are never shaken by the events which happen in life. So this is keeping that Dhamma in mind. It's the mindfulness which remembers the teachings, which sees things not in the framework of this is mine, this belongs to me, this is my possession, and I really cry when I lose it. We never look at things as this is going to be really happy. We look upon these things as just the gap between two states of suffering. This suffering is a gap between two states of pleasure. It has to change by itself. So we never cling to things in life. So by looking at things in terms of the three characteristics, anicca, dukkha, anatta, all the time, unremittingly, then that's what it means, the mindfulness of an arahat, the mindfulness of an enlightened being. They see that, they know that. Interestingly, the difference between the mindfulness of a stream winner and the mindfulness of an arahat is the stream winner has that mindfulness, remembering the teachings intermittently. And a lovely example of that is Venerable Ananda, who at the time of the Buddha's death was a stream winner for many years and was enormous knowledge of Buddha's teachings, of the Dhamma. But even so, now and again, he'd just lose it, he'd forget. And especially when the Buddha was dying. He had so much affection for the Buddha that when the Buddha was actually dying, Ananda just went aside and started crying. He was just so upset. This was a stream winner. And afterwards he recalled that experience and said, at that moment, as the way he put it, the four directions weren't clear to me. The Dharma had disappeared. I didn't know what I was doing. Just from grief, from the emotions of loss, he completely forgot that whatever arises must pass away. Impermanent are all compounded things. But then, soon after, he remembered again. Remembered that this is not a Buddha dying. This is just the five khandhas, the five groups. They arose, they have to pass away again. And that's it. So that's the difference between the mindfulness of an arahat and the mindfulness of a stream winner. So the mindfulness enlightenment factor is much more than just bare awareness. It is the awareness which is free from the five hindrances and which recalls and remembers the Dhamma, which looks upon life in terms of that Dhamma. That's the mindfulness enlightenment factor. When they talk about the enlightenment factors in the suttas, they always add the words at the very end, the mindfulness enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, which is supported by dispassion, which is supported by cessation, and which ripens in relinquishment. Those words are very rarely mentioned when I hear talks on enlightenment factors, but they're so powerful and meaningful. It's the enlightenment factors of even mindfulness, which is supported by viveka. That seclusion, once you learn Pali and you see this word seclusion, then you remember that word from somewhere else. Where you remember it from is first jhana. Secluded from the five senses, secluded from unwholesome states. That's called citta viveka, seclusion of the mind. And what this is actually saying, once you read Pali and understand this, it is saying this is mindfulness which is supported by that seclusion of jhanas. And as I've been mentioning before, and some of you have got some experience enough to fully understand this, that if you get into a deep meditation, afterwards your mindfulness is really strong. And it's of a different level than before. When you go and look at the grass, or you look at the leaves, they are bright, they are shiny, they glisten. That's the increase in mindfulness. The batteries of your torch have been charged. When you look anywhere, you just see so much more. Dull mindfulness is like coming here early in the morning, all the lights are out, just got the candles, you just see silhouettes. You're not quite sure who's here and who's not here. After jhana, it's like putting 1,000 megawatt bulbs in the roof here and shining it. It's like being on a film set. Everything is just so bright and shiny. That's what happens when mindfulness is supported by viveka. And this is one of the reasons why, if mindfulness is going to be an enlightenment factor, it's going to be powerful enough to create that penetration of the Dhamma, remembering the Dhamma and seeing the Dhamma, you need that degree of mindfulness, the mindfulness which is empowered. The ordinary mindfulness of daily life, driving to work, doing your jobs, you should have at least seen from this retreat, is of a very different quality. The mindfulness which is necessary for enlightenment is the mindfulness when the five hindrances are gone, which you've felt sometimes or tasted sometimes after a good meditation. That's why it says it has to be resting, founded on viveka, founded upon dispassion. So when you're mindful of something, you're not sort of investing it with any qualities of you want it, you don't want it. You're just mindful, aware of it. And rested on, resting on cessation, on things ending. So saying this morning, Ajahn Chah used to love the word endings. When things end, things become simple. With stopping, finishing, that's where you get the peace, the space to be mindful. And which ripens in relinquishment. This word relinquishment is called wosaga. And when I just was looking at this passage this morning, I just remembered as one of the teachings elsewhere in the text which really helped me with my meditation was in the Indriya Sanyutta, where the Buddha said that if you make this wasaga, this relinquishment, this giving up, this letting go, your basic mind state, the focus of your mind, such a meditator easily obtains one-pointedness of mind, easily obtains samadhi. This is a way to easily meditate. And I was, when I came across that years and years ago, it meant so much to me, because I started my meditation not trying to gain something, but trying to give up something. I made wasaga, relinquishment, letting go, the main emphasis in my mind. When I did that, it's easy to meditate. That's why I've been teaching all this retreat. Don't try and attain something, don't try and get something, get into the present moment. Let go of craving. Make relinquishing, letting go, renouncing, giving away, make that the center of your mind. And when you make that the central theme of your mind, just let go, renounce, whatever it is, no desire, abandon, relinquish, toss off. It's like being in a balloon. The more ballast you throw out, the higher you fly, the easier it is to meditate. And this is what the Buddha actually said: meditation becomes easy, without difficulty, the more you develop wasaga, renouncing, letting go, relinquishing. So much so that whatever comes into your mind, you just tend to toss it away. Whether it's present, past moment, future, any thoughts, relinquish, let go, relinquish, let go. It ripens in relinquishment. If you have that the theme of your mind, the inclination of the mind, it becomes so easy to meditate. So that's why the Buddha said this mindfulness enlightenment factor even has to be founded, based on, literally sitting on, seclusion of the body and mind, especially the mind in jhanas, based on dispassion, based on cessation, ripening in this full letting go. So that's why being mindful when you're having sex with somebody, it's not based on dispassion, it's not based on seclusion, it doesn't ripen in letting go. It ripens in attachment. It's a different type of mindfulness. It's not the enlightenment factor. The same is the next enlightenment factor of Dhamma Vicaya. Investigating into Dhammas. Sometimes the meaning of Dhamma is multiple, and sometimes people have to know what the real source meaning of Dhamma is before they can really understand all of its secondary meanings. And I thank Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi for doing a lovely article once on the meaning of Dhamma and the meaning of its opposite, Atta. When there's any phenomena, anything which exists in the world, where it comes from, its source, is Dhamma. Where it leads to, its consequence, its purpose, its meaning, is Atta. Dhamma is the source, Atta is where it leads to. So when we're talking about Dhamma, especially investigating the Dhamma, we want to find out what the source of everything is. Where did this come from? Where did I come from? Where did Chaitanya come from? Where did consciousness come from? You know, when I was a young man, I used to go to the cinemas. In those days, people were allowed to smoke in the cinema. And I always remember those cinemas, because you'd see the picture there, you know, through the smoke screen. But you never really got so engrossed in the movie, because you could actually see this cone of light. You could actually trace the movie back to its source. You see this cone of light going to this projector behind you. Because you had that cone of light, you could see very easily where the source of that movie was. These days, you probably can't even see the projector because it's smoke-free. You don't really realize all the time this is just fantasy, just images, just lights on a screen. Investigating the Dhamma is like seeing a movie and tracing where did that movie come from. And you trace the light back and you see there's a machine there with some film in it and just an electric light and just the play. It's the illusion. Once you see the projector, you've seen the illusion. It's only a movie. And so when the boy meets girl at the end and they ride off to the sunset, you don't get all sort of woozy and sort of think, oh, isn't that lovely, isn't that wonderful? It's just light, that's all. When somebody dies, or when the alien sort of jumps out, or the shark jumps out, whatever else it is you're watching, you don't sort of jump. It's just light on the screen, that's all. When you come to the source of things, you find you've got far more peace and equanimity. In the same way, what you're experiencing now, what you're hearing now, what you're feeling now, where does it come from? Where's its source? So the Dhamma with you is trying to find the source of this. If you're trying to find the consequence of this, where does this lead to? That's called papancha, proliferation. It means you go thinking, 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 all over the place. There's no end to that. But you really want to find, go in the opposite direction. This is why a very beautiful story. Before the Buddha became enlightened, he wanted to find out whether he had what it takes to become enlightened. He made a resolution before putting his bowl in the river, saying, if the bowl floats upstream, then may it be a sign that I can be enlightened. That I've got what it takes. And of course the bowl floated upstream. And that was a very beautiful a very beautiful simile, because that actually showed what you need to do. So the cravings have this word, the asavas, the outflowings of the mind, actually take your attention out there somewhere. So when you're angry at that person out there, or that traffic light out there, or that meditation, or that teacher out there. And it always takes you out from yourself. That is the stream of the world. When you have desire, you want that beautiful dress, you want that beautiful cake, you want that which is out there somewhere. And it takes you away from the source inside of yourself, out there into the world. That's why it's called an asava, an outflowing, taking your attention from the source, from the Dhamma, out there into the world. You have to go against the stream to do Dhamma vichaya. Always going to the source of things. Why? Where did that craving come from? Not how can I fulfill it. Why did I become angry? Not how can I get my own back on that person. Find out the why. Go to the source of this, the origin of this, the womb of it. That's why this particular type of movement of the mind has also got another word in Pali, called yonisa manasikara, sometimes called like wise attention, wise thinking. But when you analyze the meaning of the word, it does literally mean, literally word for word mean, manasikara means work of the mind, yonisa means from the womb. Yoni is a Pali word for a womb, where babies are born, where little puppies come from. It's work of the mind which goes back to the source of things. That's what yonisa manasikara means. And that is one of the most important things for becoming a stream winner. The two factors for becoming a stream winner are yonisa manasikara and paragosa. Words from another and your own work of the mind going to the source. You need help from somebody else to become a stream winner. From Dhamma from an Arya, or especially Dhamma from the Buddha, together with your own Dhamma vichaya, which goes inwards, which finds out the meaning of things. There you have the enlightenment factor. In particular, in this retreat, when you have that beautiful mindfulness made of deep meditation, go inwards and find out who's thinking this, who's seeing this. Well, actually, instead of saying who, say what is seeing this. Instead of saying who am I, say what am I. It's a different question. Who am I means that you think you are something, you just haven't found who it is yet. The question who am I assumes an answer. What am I assumes something much broader, that you are a process. You might be a person. But let's leave that open. You might just be a process. What am I? What is will? What is consciousness? What is perception? That's why we call it tamawitya. It goes to the source of things. It's not just any old contemplation, but contemplation which goes to the very beginning, to Dhamma, the origin of things. The next enlightenment factor is energy, unremitting energy. Sometimes that's hard to do, isn't it, to have energy? And I've mentioned here, one of the reasons why we don't have energy is because we're fed up, we've got ill will, we're depressed. It's very easy. I used to notice this, that sometimes, I was even thinking this last night, because I was quite tired last night, went to bed about 10:30, and I thought as I was going to bed, I thought, you know, that if I was a young man, and this was a Saturday night, and I was having a party, 10:30, I would never go to bed at 10:30. Sometimes when I was young, I'd stay up all night having a party. Sometimes a couple of nights in a row, you know, when it's light when you're young. And I never got tired. I said, what's the difference? It's because I had so much joy and happiness. I was enjoying that party. I thought it was fun. That's why I could stay up late. If there's a very lovely movie on late at night and you really wanted to see it, and you're looking forward to it, you won't get sleepy. Isn't energy a measure of the happiness you have in life? If you really enjoy what you're doing, you've got all the energy in the world. If you hate what you're doing, you're tired, you're depressed, you just haven't got sort of anything to give to life. That's why when you know the secret of energy, you realize that if you do austere practices, if you push yourself and experience physical pain or mental pain in this retreat, you just haven't got the energy to get up in the morning. You just want to sleep, you want to dull out, you want to get into sloth and torpor. However, if you're enjoying the meditation, if you're doing the perception of the beautiful in this meditation retreat or even in life, then you have all the energy in the world. That's why, get up in the morning, smile at yourself. When you get up in the morning, Monday morning, hey, Monday morning, I can go to work today, marvellous. Perceive the beautiful on a Monday morning when you've got to go to work. When you've got to go to the dentist, perceive the beautiful. Isn't it marvellous going to the dentist? I love going to the dentist. You just sit down in the chair there and you don't do anything. So one time in my life when no one can ask me a Dhamma question, because I've got all these things in my mouth, so I can't ask. So they leave me alone when I'm in the dentist chair. So it's a marvellous opportunity. You can see the beautiful in anything. I remember sort of somebody told me about a person like this. They were so positive. They would never say a bad word about anybody. And so, you know, these, they really sort of set this, their fellow workers up the wall. Because, you know, it's just so positive. So they met together. They said, we'll test him out. And they came to him and said, okay, now come and say something good about Adolf Hitler. And this man paused. That was a tough one. And he said, he was the leader in his field. And I really respect that man, because he could see something positive in anybody. He could see something positive in any experience, and that's why you have lots of energy. If you're having a lot of suffering, it's a marvellous time for growing wisdom. It's great, because you're learning something. You're learning the Buddha's first noble truth, suffering. So if it's hard work, thank you so much. And if it's easy work, oh, thank you so much, you're getting an extra paycheck today. So you're getting some joy and value in whatever you do. If you're young, you've got energy to do so much. If when you're old and sick, you've got the opportunity to let other people serve you and make good karma. Isn't it a wonderful thing to get old, to get sick? When I get sick in the monastery, all these monks can do good karma. And sometimes people love monks being sick. Because it's all these ladies whose sons have grown up and got wives, and you've got these monks, they're just perfect, they've got no wife looking after them, and so they can go knock out. I've got to be very careful when I'm sick, because when I'm sick and people find out, everyone gives me medicines. So it's like you have 1,000 mothers as a monk, and everyone comes up to you and say, you must take this, it'll really work. I say, yes, mother. That's what it's like. And of course, the story about this one monk who went to visit his family in New York. New York. When he was there, it was winter time, he slipped on the ice, had an accident, broke his arm. So he was in hospital for a few days. When his mother came to visit him, a couple of hours after the accident, she had this huge smile on her face. She was so happy that her son had broken his arm, because she looked at him and said, "At last I've got you where I want you. I can mother you and you can't run away." So even in sickness you can give a great gift to other people. There's lots to learn. So that positive attitude is where you get energy from. The positive people have always got heaps and heaps of energy. The negative, the fault finders, the dull, always sort of get bored and get depressed at life. Can hardly get up in the morning and are very sleepy. A lot of sloth and torpor comes from that, sort of the negative attitude to life. So energy is an enlightenment factor. The enlightened beings are always full of energy because they're full of joy. They can get up really early in the morning. Ajahn Chah was amazing just how much energy he had. But he also had a lot of fun as well. The two went together. The next enlightenment factor is obvious, it's piti. Because piti is that joy which comes from energy. Energy comes from joy. These two factors go around each other. Piti is that sense of joy, that sense of delight in the world. It's sometimes delight in the world, but the piti here is that delight in the otherworldly states. That's why it actually said here, if I remember correctly, that in one who has aroused energy, unworldly rapture arises. Because it's rapture, joy which is in the world for listening to your favourite music or eating your favourite restaurant or going to a movie. But this is that the joy which is not of the world, and this is why it's an enlightenment factor, does not need to be feared. This is the joy and happiness you feel having had a good meditation. Just the joy of peace, the joy of simplicity. Even seeing nature is called the unworldly joy because it's so peaceful, it's tranquilizing. You just watch the birds fly up and mess around in the trees. You just see the trees just move in the wind. You listen to the sound of the wind. You see the sunsets. You see the flowers. You see the peace in your own mind and body. You see the joy of Dhamma. You see the happiness of realizing you're getting that bit closer to release. It brings this enormous sense of happiness and joy, the inspiration. That's the joy, the piti, which comes from energy. The two go around each other. It's called Niramisa because it's nothing to be feared. People sometimes think that monks shouldn't be having fun. They think that monks should be just any type of fun, enjoyment whatsoever, monks shouldn't sort of have. You should be sitting there just with what I call the horizontal mouth. And I was just so relieved when I went to Thailand to see Ajahn Chah smiling, cracking jokes, he had an enormous sense of humour, and all these other monks, great senses of humour, and see them playing around, and then looking at the suttas and seeing in the time of the Buddha, monks did the same. Monks were not always serious, like Puritans. There was some joy there to be had, and that joy really encouraged me to become a monk. Because I thought that if someone was enlightened, they should be happy. If they ended suffering, they must be happy. I wanted to see a happy monk, someone who'd ended suffering. And when I saw a happy monk, you had the encouragement that it was possible, it can be done. So that happiness was a great marketing tool for Buddhism. Because in this world, there's Christianity, there's Islam, there's New Age, or there's just going to the movies and going to the football and just enjoying yourself that way. Which path would people take in the world? A lot of people would take the path of greatest happiness. And if they see, like monks or priests, just being really boring and dull and just really being upset and miserable, really, who would follow that path? That's sometimes why the churches become empty, because the priests are so dull and miserable. Not all of them, but some. So this is why so that it's important to get that piti, that joy. It's an enlightenment factor even, because from piti, from that joy, you get this marvelous and this unworldly joy. This next factor is powerful. From piti, you get tranquility, because that joy is feeding the mind what it's wanting. The piti is the energy of the mind. If the mind is full, satisfied, it won't go looking for happiness somewhere else. If the mind has not got that food of piti, joy and happiness, it will always be restless. It will always be wanting something more, something else, somewhere. And this is actually what you feel in meditation. Once you get a bit of joy in your meditation, the body becomes tranquil, the mind becomes tranquil. Two aspects of tranquility. The bodily tranquility is marvelous to behold, because the lack of bodily tranquility, when you've got all these aches and pains, heat and cold, and you can never keep the body still because it's always uncomfortable. And you've seen people in meditation, you've seen me in meditation, when you start meditation, you've got to keep moving around because you can't get a comfortable position, but then when you stop and get into your meditation, you're absolutely still. You're not trying hard to keep the body still, you're not tense and tight and using force. Bodily tranquility comes naturally through the meditation, and the sign of that bodily tranquility is that lightness, that peace in the body. There are no itches, no aches, the body feels just so comfortable. It amazes you, the most comfortable position for your body is sitting on your meditation cushion, not on a water bed, not on a four-poster bed. No matter how many mattresses you have in your bed, you can never be as comfortable as you get in meditation. Because in meditation you get tranquility of the body. And that tranquility of the body gives this marvelous ease. The body is light, free, not disturbing you anymore. That is a marvelous sign of the meditation. That gives so much freedom from bodily suffering. At last, the body is beginning to disappear. And you get the same tranquility of the mind. Instead of the mind being all over the place, and you know that restless mind, that frantic mind, that crazy mind, the mind is starting to relax. It can keep its attention on one object. It's just there, and it doesn't want to move. In the same way, your body doesn't need all this attention, scratching, moving, rubbing. Your mind doesn't need all this attention. It just stays. It's comfortable. Tranquility is another form of contentment. In these enlightenment factors, they don't mention the next stage, except in passing. Because at this point in the enlightenment factors, the whole process, which is repeated very many times by the Buddha, is starting to happen. From piti comes prasadi. From this joy comes tranquility of body and mind. From tranquility of body and mind comes inner happiness, this inner joy, the beautiful of the breath, which I keep talking about. It is actually mentioned in passing here, when they say, in one whose body is tranquil and who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. From tranquility, you will always get the pleasure of the mind. Just the joy, the happiness, that beauty, that delight in the meditation. Once tranquility is there, it's just so lovely just being here. That is the pleasure. It's different than the pleasure of delicious food. It's different than the pleasure of sex. It's different than the pleasure of like seeing a movie. This is a very refined, peaceful pleasure, but they're pleasurable nevertheless. And once you notice them, they're just incredibly delightful. They're refined pleasures. For those who are connoisseurs of pleasure, this is a much more delightful one. Connoisseurs of pleasure are called the meditating monks. I'm a connoisseur of pleasure. Only the very fine pleasures of life will I get into. And this is actually what happens, because once you start to get that pleasure of the mind, as I've been saying all this retreat, then you get samadhi, which is the next enlightenment factor. From that tranquility comes pleasure, which is not actually mentioned as an enlightenment factor, but it's implied there. From that pleasure comes samadhi. That samadhi is that deep, sustained attention deep within the jhana. All your meditations will always come from tranquility followed by beauty in the mind. The mind just gets hold of that beauty and just builds it up, stays with it. That's called samadhi. That's the enlightenment factor. Again, based on viveka, secluded from the world. The world is busy. The world disturbs. The world destroys. Inside, you have a bit of safety and security from that suffering. That samadhi, which is the enlightenment factor, has to be the samadhi of jhana or post-jhana. The samadhi which is again freed from those five hindrances. Sometimes they have in Buddhism what they call upachara samadhi. Sometimes they call it neighborhood concentration. It just, what it means is just like threshold. Just when you come into this room here, there's a threshold you have to pass. You know, usually a mat in front of the door. But also when you go out again, there is a mat. When you go into a jhana, you have to pass that threshold. When you go out, you pass that threshold. The important point is that as far as those two types of threshold concentration are concerned, the one before jhana is very unstable and uncertain. You're not really sure whether you're there or not. Very often you're not. However, the upachara after jhana is incredibly stable, lasts for a long time, and that's why that's usually the time people get enlightened. And the state just after jhana, where the five hindrances are completely knocked out for long periods of time. That's the sort of samadhi which is necessary for enlightenment. That's why it is true in a sense, it doesn't mean jhana samadhi here, upachara is enough, but it has to be the upachara samadhi as a result of jhanas. Sometimes people come along these days and they say all sorts of other types of samadhi. They got this terrible word from the commentaries called kanika samadhi. Kanika samadhi means momentary concentration. And that's why that sometimes, sort of, I really sort of make a big deal about this. And I don't really mean to offend people, but I think it deserves being offended against because it's such a stupid idea. Samadhi means sustained attention. If you're reading a book even, like when you're studying, if you can keep reading the book and you're really reading it for many minutes and you're really concentrated, that's a type of samadhi. But would you really call it concentration if you read a book and go and talk to you over there and then go and read a book some more and go and look at this and read a book more and have a cup of coffee and then read a book? That's not concentration, that's not samadhi, but this is what people say is kanika, momentary samadhi. Samadhi, then you go and do something else. It's impossible. It cannot come to pass. There's no such thing as kanika, samadhi, momentary concentration. You cannot momentarily sustain your attention. You're sustained or you're not. You're restless or you're peaceful. So kanika samadhi is just an attempt, just because sometimes people know that samadhi is necessary and they haven't got samadhi, so they bring samadhi down to their level, rather than bringing their level up to samadhi. They bring enlightenment down to where they're at, rather than trying to bring themselves up to what enlightenment requires. So kanika samadhi just doesn't mean anything. The Buddha never mentioned that word anywhere in the suttas. Real samadhi is jhanas, or the time when the five hindrances have gone as a result of those jhanas. That's this samadhi enlightenment factor. And the last of the enlightenment factors is upekkha. But listen to what it says here. They closely look on with equanimity of the mind thus concentrated. On whatever occasion the mind closely looks on with equanimity of the mind thus concentrated, on that occasion the equanimity enlightenment factor is aroused. It's not equanimity on anything. It's not just being so equanimous that one doesn't want to do anything. It's not being indifferent. It's an equanimity born of samadhi which looks upon that samadhi. That's the equanimity of the enlightenment factors. because sometimes people misunderstand what equanimity is all about. In fact, the purity of equanimity, the purity of mindfulness, is always said to occur in the fourth jhana. That's where you realize what equanimity truly is. The equanimity, the ability just to look without being attached in one way or another. Sometimes people look and they can't see their attachments. They think they're detached when they're looking. It's just because of ignorance. They cannot see where they're holding on. That's only when you've really let go you can see what your attachments are. That's why I said to many people in the interviews during this meditation retreat, when you've been aiming at full release of the mind into jhanas, if you've had any problem gaining those jhanas, if there's been any obstacle, it means you've been confronting an attachment. If you had no attachments, there'd be nothing between you and jhanas, you'd be able to go in with ease whenever you wanted. An arahat has got full and easy access to jhanas. What it means is you're testing whether you've got any attachments. If a person can't get into jhanas, there's an attachment there. There's something which is holding them back. So this is where you get enormously powerful insight. When you get to an obstacle, why can't you go deeper? That's an attachment there. Find out what it is. That's where you really find out what craving and attachment really is. Not just as a theory. You find it out in your own experience as that which blocks you from freedom. That which stops you being at peace. And there you actually see for yourself the attachments which you have. Whether this is a controller, that's the attachment to self. The attachment to the body, that's karma upadana, attachment to the five senses. Whether it's just the fear which comes up because you're about to let go of the doer, that's bhava dhanaha, the craving to be. These are the points where you really gain insight. You're coming across not just theories but experiences. You're coming not just the name of attachment, you're coming up to see what attachment is, how it works and how it binds. And this is where the work of a meditator is. By making that goal of jhanas, you have to come across and face up to attachment and craving. When you get that bit further and you overcome them and you get into jhanas, then you know all of the attachments, especially the very fine, the subtle attachments, which not only stop you getting jhanas, which also tie you to samsara and to rebirth. And that's where insight arises, the beautiful, powerful, liberating insight. And you know it's an insight because it clears the path. So those are the seven enlightenment factors. They're not easy, they are very profound and they are very deep. So bring them up again, they are mindfulness. Mindfulness freed from the five hindrances, based on seclusion. They are investigating the Dhamma, the source of things, especially the knower and the doer. Energy. Piti, joy. This is a joyful path. Arahats are happy people. It's an enlightenment factor. Tranquility of body and tranquility of mind. Samadhi. The ability just to let go of the whole world and be absolutely still. At the upekkha. The equanimity which you can just look on these days. Those are the seven enlightenment factors. Once you know what they are, try and develop them. They're again, they're born of, they rest on things like viveka upon seclusion. That's why many of them just grow as a result of this practice by themselves. In fact, what I read out here was the last part of the Anapanasati Sutta and the mindfulness of breathing, which says if you cultivate the mindfulness of the breath, all the way through jhanas, these enlightenment factors arise. In fact, the Anapanasati Sutta says, do Anapanasati till you get through the jhanas, then do the four foundations of mindfulness, then you'll find the seven factors of enlightenment coming up, then you'll be enlightened. Easy. So, any questions on seven factors of enlightenment? Okay, it's you and me. Sorry, Alice, you didn't get your hand up quite quick enough. Put it on a piece of paper. Only one question. Yes? Yeah? Idipada. That's the subject of another talk. Idipada. That's very interesting. That, again, that's what motivates as part of the arousing of energy. To arouse energy, you have to have some sort of goal, some sort of direction. Here it's a direction of letting go. So the four idipadas are the aspiration to let go. And you sustain that aspiration. Because you have that aspiration, energy will arise as a result of that aspiration. You keep applying the mind on that aspiration until you achieve. You keep trying to let go, it doesn't matter how long it takes, you're going to keep on going. The only people who fail are the people who give up. The only people who fail are those who give up. You keep on going. This path leads in one direction only. You have to get jhanas, you have to get enlightened. It is only a matter of time. This path leads in one direction only. The only people who fail are the ones who give up. Citta samadhi is the Cittipadana samadhi is the sustaining the application of the mind. Keeping on going. And the last one is vimaksa. Is using that investigation. When you have an aspiration, you've got the energy, you're keeping on going, obstacles will come up from time to time. Don't just keep banging your head against the brick wall when an obstacle comes up in your meditation. Stand back, look to the left, and you'll find there's a door. Look to the right, you'll find there's a ladder which goes over the wall. But so often we just bang our heads on the same point of the brick wall and we get samadhi headache. We keep on making the same mistake. What we need to do is stand back. You're getting difficulty in your meditation. Stand back. What is going on? Why? That's that reminds you. If you look just around you, left and right, you'll see there's openings in the door. If it's ill will, there's a loving kindness opening just to the left. You just go right past that ill will. If it's restlessness, there's a letting go ladder to the right. You just, you know, get on that letting go ladder and it takes you right to the other side of the wall. These are all ways of using vimansa. Sometimes we get so, as it were, concentrated, we lose our perspective. Our view is just too narrow. So we might as well just stand back and just get a perspective of what's happening, what the problem is. Find out the solution, and you're through. Those are the four idipadas. But to go deeply into them, it's another talk. But that's enough for now. So, that's the talk on the seven factors of enlightenment. Now is the time, having talked about them, to do them.